and welcome to this month's episode of Sitfor Speaks. On this episode, we're focusing on all things tech in celebration of Sitfor's recently released blockchain report. The public sector is facing many challenges, so innovations in technology will become relied upon more and more to help the sector meet the needs of the public. On this month's episode, we'll hear from Jeffrey Matsu, who is Sitfor's chief economist, who is in conversation with Mehdi Shiva, a research leader at RAND Europe. I also spoke with Caitlin Bentley, who is a lecturer at King's College London in AI education, and she is also a co-lead in the skills programme at Responsible AI UK. So without further ado, let's get into the episode. We really hope you enjoy listening. Up first, we'll hear from Jeffrey Matsu speaking to Mehdi Shiva.
Hi, Mehdi, and thanks for joining us on this special technology-focused edition of Sitfor Speaks. Would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yes. Hi, Jeff. Thanks so much for having me. I am Mehdi Shiva. I am a research leader at RAND Europe.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We've recently just published a few weeks ago a major new insights report that you helped to author while you were at the Government Outcomes Lab at the University of Oxford. Mm-hmm. That report that examined the potential uses of blockchain technology in the public sector. So my first question for you will be, we've all probably heard about blockchain, but some of us probably don't know really what it is. So can you just walk us through some simplistic steps as to what blockchain is and how the public sector might benefit from that?
Sure thing. I'm not an expert in blockchain as well. So my understanding is coming from the number of interviews that we had speaking to experts and also the surveys and reading just the existing literature. So from my understanding, blockchain is a chain of information. So we can look at it as a platform to store information, and they are all interconnected. And this information, they could be in different types. They could be financial information, they could be personal information, geolocation, any type of information could be stored on blockchain.
No, I think that's a good starting point. And of course, we know that one of the nice benefits of blockchain is that it's secured through what sort of technical people call cryptography, and that by linking information together in this more secure way, that could provide benefits. Can you tell us a little bit about just the background of how this report came to be, as cutting edge technology like this probably isn't associated with the public sector and local government?
Sure thing. That's a great question. So a super short answer is curiosity. We were really curious at the point about what is this blockchain that everyone is talking about, because especially I'm sure you had the same experience as me, that there are still two types of voices around blockchain, similar to any other cutting edge technologies. There are some lovers and some haters. So on the lover side, there was this huge, maybe there still is, there was this huge vibe on blockchain and its future. And the discussions around its disrupting role, that it's going to shape the future, it's going to replace all existing systems. And at the moment, I think these type of voices are a bit less colorful compared to before, because now AI is the kind of the big thing. On the other side, there were some people that they really hated blockchain because of its association with crypto and Bitcoin. So because there were lots of issues around scams and issues with different kind of like trading exchanges for crypto, that people didn't really trust the idea, and they thought blockchain is solely about Bitcoin and crypto. But at the same time, we were really working on, last year, we were working on kind of like how we can improve impact and value of expenditure, including public expenditure. And we were focusing on the impact and outcome side of things. And we were hearing that blockchain could help us with evaluation and verifiability. And we were hearing that it's going to make things much easier because evaluation of outcomes and impact could happen automatically. And we can verify whether or not the objectives or the outcomes or the impact that we were looking for was achieved or not. Through this research, we learned that although there are some great features of blockchain that could support that, but that is not true generally. There are specific cases that blockchain could facilitate verification and evaluation of impacts and outcomes. But this is not the case for all different types of interventions or programs that we have in mind.
And I remember when we were conducting the survey and interviews with practitioners, yeah, that there was a lot of interest in innovation more broadly in the public sector and how public finance professionals could engage with technology in a more progressive way to do things that government currently does a bit more efficiently and effectively. Which brings me to my next question for you, that the report finds blockchain can offer the public sector some key benefits, such as supporting relationships, building trust, and enhancing coordination, transparency, and accountability. Can you speak to these findings and unpack them slightly for our audience?
There are lots of potentials in blockchain for public finance as well. So we identified three kind of key features for blockchain, including immutability, decentralization, and programmability. Immutability basically means that when data is stored, it's going to be there forever. You can change it, but the previous record is going to be there too. So you cannot delete anything on the chain. Decentralization basically means that it cannot be controlled by one specific person or entity, and there is a more democratic kind of a regime in decision making. And programmability is basically that you can program some of the tasks to be kind of performed automatically. So with respect to public finance, I think there are some potentials there. As for example, for accountability and transparency, I think there are some really interesting areas for further exploration. And for example, because data cannot be deleted, and also because you can trace back the data that where it came from and where it's going, that would automatically, I would say, help with accountability. So you know who is doing what with what you have given them, what you have provided. So if you are talking about resources, you know exactly where the resource is coming from, where they are going, what is happening to them. And on the transparency side, if you make this, I don't think this is ever going to happen with the public sector, but if you make this kind of a like a public kind of a chain, then everyone could see that. So for decentralization, again, the idea is that, for example, one specific entity within the government is not going to be in charge of controlling everything, and different sectors and departments could have a say in how to run things and how to allocate resources. Again, that is a potential in theory. For programmability, of course, some of the tasks in the public sector, for example, if it's about tax, if it's about exemptions, if it's about specific kind of like public sector, public finance kind of activities that could be programmed and automatized, it has substantial potentials as well.
Yeah, that's very interesting reflections on the benefits of blockchain. And I think they will become more important, especially when we're in a period of high cost and low economic growth. Being able to bring people and government departments to do things better, to manage not just the relationships, but also things like contract negotiations, having that all on a chain that people can see in a mm-hmm. coordinated way. And also importantly, as you mentioned, being able to track, monitor, and evaluate outcomes, which public spending should really be held accountable for, making sure that we're spending public funds wisely. I think those are some of the areas that, as you say, blockchain can provide benefit. So thank you for that. There's been lots of hype around blockchain as it's wrapped up in cryptocurrencies, which have often made headlines around the world. But our report is keen to point out that the available evidence for blockchain's potential doesn't always support its hype. What are the downsides or the major risks of using blockchain specifically in the public sector?
Those features that they discussed earlier, so immutability, decentralization, and programmability, these are kind of the key features that we identified during this research, and they could bring lots of benefits and positive impact. But at the same time, there are some limitations with each of these features as well. So, for example, immutability, of course, really helpful to help with accountability, because you can actually get rid of anything, you know, like nothing can be really deleted. You can just add new information to the existing ones if you want to make revisions. But at the same time, sometimes errors happen. And if you cannot change an input, that is going to kind of limit some of the applications. And that is kind of that, I think, limits flexibility and use cases of blockchain. At the same time, with decentralization, so the whole idea around blockchain is that it cannot be controlled by one person or one specific entity. And it's going to kind of like distribute the power across a large range of people, entities, or stakeholders, and they're all going to have a say in this, and it's going to kind of like improve democratic institutes. But at the same time, we still need a system to control even the blockchain. It cannot just function by its own. It needs to be controlled, and so there should be some people or some entities still in charge. At the same time, about the democratic power dynamic side of things, although we can take the power away from some organizations or some people and share some of it to others, but at the same time, like any other technology, like the AI as well, there will be some new powers coming in place because of their better understanding of the new technology, of their better understanding of blockchain, or having stronger computing systems so they can deal with the infrastructure, with the system better.
And apart from, you know, some of the financial risks that governments may take on when embedding technologies like blockchain into the ways they do things, there's also that reputational risk of trying things in a different way and then failing versus just maintaining the status quo, even if the outcomes are ultimately ineffective. And so I suppose that there is that dimension of risk from both reputation and financial perspectives.
Exactly. As John Keynes has said in his The General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money, John Keynes said that worldly wisdom teaches that it's better for reputation to fail conventionally than to succeed unconventionally. So you're absolutely right, Jeff.
I would just flag up that one of the risks that could be a longer term benefit from blockchain is job displacement in certain industries, right? That blockchain, that technology changes the rules of employment and the requirements of competencies, knowledge, skills, and attitudes of employees. So on my final point and question for you would be that longer term vision and prospects for technology such as blockchain. Are we destined for a future public sector run by machines?
That is a very difficult question. I don't know really, like, because it's not just about blockchain. Nowadays, everyone's talking about ChatGPT, everyone's talking about AI, kind of like these kind of like robots. But this is not the first time that we are dealing with a breakthrough technology. We've dealt with this over and over in the past years, and we always find a way to survive. So around the arguments of that technology could displace people, could, you know, like increase unemployment rates, and some people are going to be left behind. Of course, that is true, but it happens to some people. So, like, some people might lose their jobs, especially, you know, like with the blockchain or with AI. Lots of the kind of tasks that could be easily automatized, they are at risk. That is very true. But at the same time, the government always, you know, like, could provide additional support for those people to maybe create new jobs or create policies, come up with the policies, like social policies, to support people who are displaced. So it's not going to be the end of the world. It's not like that we all going to be unemployed and AI and ChatGPT and blockchain are going to run the governments. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think it's the first time that this is happening. By I don't think, I mean, I'm certain, because we have seen this. We have seen internet, for example. Initially, people were scared that, oh God, what is going to happen? But at the same time, we know that there are policies to protect people. There are regulations. At the time, governments are a bit behind on regulating AI. That's why lots of the leading voices are actually asking governments to do something about that, about regulations, that we can be in charge of what is happening. But if we use the right policies, whether public policy or it's public finance around where to finance, how to support people, then no, I don't think it's going to be the outcomes are going to be that miserable and scary. No, I think we're going to be fine.
For what it's worth, creative destruction, certainly in my opinion, opens up new opportunities for people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the key areas where government can provide the leadership and support for local communities in developing those skill sets and competencies to thrive in these new opportunities. But on that note, thank you very much, Mehdi, for your time today.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
That was Jeffrey Matsu, CIPFA's chief economist, speaking with Mehdi Shiva, who is a research lead at RAND Europe. Up next, we'll hear from Caitlin Bentley, who is a lecturer at King's College London in AI education and is also a co-lead in the skills programme at Responsible AI UK.
Okay, so I'm joined by Caitlin Bentley from King's College London. Caitlin, please could you introduce yourself and let us know a bit about your role?
Hi, Harriet. My name is Caitlin Bentley. I'm a lecturer in AI education at King's College London, and I'm also the co-lead on the skills program for Responsible AI UK, which is a new initiative designed to bring together the ecosystem of responsible AI here in the UK.
So yeah, as you said, we're here to talk about artificial intelligence. And that's still something that to a lot of people seems like, you know, something out of a science fiction novel for most people. So could you give our listeners a sense of what AI is and how advanced the current technology is, like what kinds of things it's capable of and things like that?
Yeah, I think what's important to recognize is that AI is a large constellation of different kinds of technologies. And this can mean anything from the use of sensors, machine learning algorithms, computer vision, natural language processing. And usually these are used to do advanced data analytics. They feed into different predictions, make automated decisions, and those predictions and decision making is then fed back into a system through people, other system actuators. Those are things that move things like robot arms or cars and other system structures or equipment. And so ultimately, I view AI as a collection of technologies that can be built into a system, like an AI-enabled system. Recently, we've been hearing a lot about generative AI because this has been a bit of a breakthrough in a type of deep learning. And this refers to a subset of artificial intelligence models that, you know, they claim to generate new content, but really, because they're built on large bodies of historical data, then they use what patterns that they've recognized in that data to make predictions about what might be the prediction or the response. It could be anything from text to images to videos in response to those prompts. So is that sort of what you were thinking about when you thought about AI? Is this new type of generative AI?
I suppose so, yeah. I mean, it's interesting to hear you say that there's so many different types of AI, because I think when you're kind of, you know, the average person, I would think of a robot who's making their own decisions kind of intelligently. But yeah, it's interesting to hear you say that it's actually based on a lot of data that has been given to the AI by somebody else, and then they're just kind of making predictions based on that.
Yeah, most often that is the case. So it is such a diverse collection of technologies and techniques that it is important for us to raise awareness that there are these wide collection of technologies, and there are different limitations and benefits as well across that spectrum.
And I think another thing that comes up often when talking about AI is people getting quite worried about it, thinking that, you know, it may take people's jobs or it might make humans obsolete. In terms of like the real world applications for AI at the moment, what kinds of things is it actually being used for, and how do you see that kind of expanding over the next few years?
So I guess I wanted to do a bit of a promotion here about Responsible AI UK, because this is a new forum for people to get involved in actually. So if people are feeling worried about AI and taking over jobs or making humans obsolete, then you do have an opportunity to get involved, to voice your opinions, to learn more about it, and to help shape a vision for AI that respects our values and helps to empower us rather than to replace us. And we have town halls all over the country coming up. So if you go to our website, rai.ac.uk, you can sign up for our newsletter, and there'll be multiple events and opportunities for people to come out, meet other people, learn a lot, and share your views. And so I think, to me, in my head, again, this is a really complex question. And again, it's been like a lot of our ideas about this has been shaped by recent media. Yeah, and of course, everybody's been talking about the writer's strike and things like that. But I think there are, I am thinking about the town hall we just had in July for RAI UK. And in a discussion about the future of work there, we were talking about how actually there's a number of jobs which people would really rather prefer that a machine could do it for us. So this is unsafe labor, or labor that's, you know, unmotivating or undesirable, then it would be great for AI to take our jobs. And I think where we're at now with AI being integrated into more of the knowledge generation tasks, like writing emails or writing scripts or writing any type of writing that generative AI is supporting, even academic work as well. Again, there are differences across different sectors and disciplines, like the writers, for example, or the actors. Like, there are distinct challenges around the creative industries. And as I was mentioning before, a lot of this quote unquote generative AI is using historical data. So do we really want to see AI writing movies or television shows for us? Probably not, because it's just going to replicate the stories that we already know. And it's really not fair for AI to be used to represent somebody's image or voice. And these are all issues that within the creative industries, we really need to take a stand and help regulators shape a vision for those sectors. But in terms of my daily life, helping me to summarize or write an email or things like that, it's a very welcome addition. And what a colleague of mine, Gordon Meadow, frequently says is that we really need to think about AI rather than as replacing us or making us obsolete, as augmenting our intelligence and helping us to do things better. And in that sense, a lot of what I like to do is think about how we can think more about how, not only how to make our jobs more efficient or add on new tasks with that time savings, And we do need to think about how we can work collaboratively with AI. And that's going to take a new type of thinking and planning around our jobs and professions, the things that we as companies, as citizens, as governments do in order to really take advantage of what human and AI teams look like.
And so in your role, you focus on the responsible use of AI and design and the governance of AI as well. So in terms of the governance, how can we use this technology in a sensible and responsible way? And what kind of measures do we need to put in place, do you think?
So a lot of the work that I do really relies on seeing AI as part of an ecosystem that is part of our societies and situated in our society, in our context. So it's grounded here. We experience it here. And we need to look at it in that way for it to be responsibly designed and governed. The kinds of measures that we might develop would be different in different areas or places. And definitely there needs to be more conversations between what technology is and does and where and how it is used, just as we just discussed. But having those discussions involves many different types of people and perspectives, not just the technology companies and business leaders, but also citizens and researchers, educators. And more we need to work collaboratively across disciplines to be able to ask the right questions and come up with effective solutions together to make these systems more trustworthy in principle and by design. And there's a lot of discussions taking place right now around policy and regulation. And there's an AI safety summit coming up in the UK that's just been announced. And these measures are really important. But I do want to speak about the measures that I tend to focus on as a lecturer in AI education, which is about making sure that people and organizations, citizens and governments, they all have responsible AI skills. And so what that means, for example, in the context of my job teaching computer science students, is that we focus a lot on building training that responds to developing ethical AI, developing their professionalism into our courses, so that when students hit the job market, they can design AI in a responsible way. And then we also have programs to make our programs more equitable in terms of widening participation or closing the attainment gap. And then in the context of Responsible AI UK, we're really interested in ensuring that everyone has the right skills to be able to have conversations about how to direct AI in their lives and in our society. And so we are trying to work with within the context of schooling, professional upskilling and reskilling within specific sectors like the maritime sector and healthcare sector. And then we're also working with policymakers and thinking a lot about what are governance skills and what type of core knowledge about AI literacy do they actually need to have to make effective policies as well.
Great. I mean, it sounds like it's a really exciting time and there's a lot of stuff that's kind of in development at the moment. The students who you teach, I'd be really interested to know kind of what sort of jobs they would go on to have. Would they all be like looking to work specifically with AI? Are they going to be the ones kind of producing the technology of the future? Like, what kind of roles is it that they want to work in?
Yeah, it's really diverse. We've just started an undergraduate AI program at King's as well. So up until now, we've had a master's program in AI, and our computer science students are able to take AI courses. And a lot of our students will graduate and work across some of these technologies. So they might work a little bit in AI or they might specialize in AI. And so a lot of our students tend to go out into many different sectors, into the technology sector, of course, into the financial services sector is a big one as well. And the public sector, we do have quite a diverse range of career pathways within this field. Then the last pathway is to continue into more research and development. So a lot of our students do stay on to study master's degrees and PhDs. And we have a doctoral training program on safe and trusted AI. And this really focuses on working collaboratively with industry partners to think about how do we make AI safer, more robust, and more responsive to the needs of society.
It's great that you have an undergraduate degree in it now as well. And so you touched there on finance. Most of our listeners are finance professionals, many of whom work in the local government. Do you think that we'll see AI being used in finance more? And what kinds of things do you think that it could be used for potentially?
Yeah, so I'll have to admit that I cheated a bit on this question using ChatGPT actually. So I wanted to share a bit of my a cognitive apprenticeship about how I used it, because this could be really important for your listeners as well. So I tend to focus on social inclusion issues like equity and inclusion, environmental sustainability, all of the public sector challenges that tend not to be associated so much with the finance sector. But I am, so I do not claim to be in any way an expert on finance, although my parents were economists. So I think maybe in some level there has been some inculcation. But anyway, so in my first attempt just to figure out what is happening with AI in finance, I asked ChatGPT and it gave me some 6 broad points about budget analysis and prediction, fraud detection, expense management, revenue forecasting, debt management, and public participation. Oh, and one more, optimizing investment. And I think, you know, when you ask ChatGPT basic questions like this, if you don't know a lot about something, then that can be used by finance professionals definitely to learn a bit about an area that you don't know a lot about, but it doesn't give you a lot of detail. You tend to have to ask it more questions. And in order to do that, I drew on my more experienced colleagues and I asked them, what would you suggest I talk about? And they also came up with fraud detection, high frequency algorithmic trading, event-based insurance. And these are all areas where I could then interrogate ChatGPT even further to understand more about those specifics. And I learned quite a lot more by taking that kind of iterative process. But I think to contextualize to the public sector, some of my experience working on an impact accelerator, which is an initiative that we have working with students and pairing them up in groups with a public sector organization. And we do this in partnership with Amazon Web Services. And it's a fabulous year-long program in which students learn to have conversations with public sector partners, understand a bit about their challenges, and then design a solution that meets their needs. And I think I just wanted to highlight one of our student groups developed a platform to visualize and analyze data on social housing policy. And this was really meant to help and support the local government authority weigh and measure different types of interventions. So, for example, if you have people whose children have moved off to college or what have you, and now they're living in an apartment that's too big for them, if you moved some of those people around, would that help free up some of the housing stock to move people on the waiting list in? And these types of questions can really be facilitated by technology. But when you think more about it in terms of what kinds of data actually need to be brought together to kind of weigh some of these scenarios, it's really quite a lot of data. So for example, you might need demographic data, you might need waiting list numbers, homelessness data, what else? You might need feedback from citizens, you might need healthcare data, you might need environmental data, you might need to include in there some of the housing policy and regulations. And all of this data tends to live in different areas. And so one of the advancements I think could be really promising is having artificial intelligence do some of that aggregation in order to help make predictions, in order to support some of the data analysis process, in order to create interesting visualizations and effective presentations. So there's really a wide spectrum of uses that could be used to support some of this decision making. But I think a couple of the areas that are really of concern to me then are around how easy it might become to identify people by linking disparate data sets. By analyzing financial information, you can often, you know, identify individuals even if you didn't intend to. And the level and extent that companies or governments are proactively addressing some of these privacy concerns through federated learning or otherwise is something that really needs to be addressed. And like working with academics is a really a great way to kind of interrogate some of your strategies and work through some of these more complex issues. And then likewise with my colleague who mentioned the event-based insurance, and as we've been talking about how AI is often built up using historical data. When we do use historical data to predict the future or what will happen in the future or future trends due to climate change or other migration patterns, there may be areas where it's really not going to work. And I think we do need to go back to that view of looking at the ecosystem's perspective of AI in a particular context, drawing in multiple different kinds of knowledge and perspectives so that we're not too short-sighted or too reliant or too focused on using AI to solve a particular problem.
I think so often with things like AI, when you're only seeing what's being portrayed in the media, kind of from films and in the news, that does tend to catastrophize things and focus a lot on the negative. But it's really fascinating to hear you talk about it in more of a, like, thinking about how we can use it positively, like how we can use it to, like you said, do things like unsafe labor, things where it could be really helpful. And what you were just talking about with the social housing, I never would have thought that AI could actually be used for something like that. So it's really interesting to hear kind of how there are so many benefits to it, I think.
Definitely. We do need to take that balanced approach, try and invest in the areas where we think it will make the most difference and ensure there are mitigations to protect against areas where it will be harmful.
Yeah. And if anyone wants to learn more about AI, are there any resources that you would suggest for people?
I would suggest signing up to our newsletter on rai.ac.uk, and we also have a section on resources. There will be, because it's a new and evolving program, there's going to be a lot of research coming out, a lot of blogs and discussions. So you'll find a lot of information there on our website.
Great, thank you. I will put those resources in the show notes for this podcast episode as well. Well, Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us. That's been really interesting.
Thank you so much.
That was Caitlin Benley, who is a lecturer at King's College London in AI education, and she is also a co-lead in the skills programme at Responsible AI UK. If you'd like to access any of the resources that Caitlin mentioned in her interview, then they will be in the show notes below. And if you'd like to read CIPFA's blockchain report, then that can be found on CIPFA's website, and I'll also include it in the show notes below as well. That's all we've got time for on this month's episode of CIPFA Speaks. We really hope that you've enjoyed listening to this episode, and we'd like to say a big thank you to both of our guests, Mehdi Shiva and Caitlin Bentley. We really appreciate their time. Don't forget to follow us on social media for more and to make sure you never miss another episode of CIPFA Speaks. Previous episodes of CIPFA Speaks can be found on CIPFA's website or wherever you like to listen to podcasts. Until next month's episode, thank you for listening and goodbye.